Welcome to the Bardcast. It's Shakespeare, you dick. We are your hosts. I am Lisa Ann Goldsmith.
I am Owen Thompson.
Merry Christmas, our
Merry
friends.
Merry Christmas, everyone. This is our Christmas episode. Christmas right. 2020.
That's right. Thus, it's called Christmas Shakespeare 2020. I'm so glad this year is almost over.
Oh, my God. We all are, of course.
But the Elizabethans celebrated Christmas for a lot longer than most of us do. They celebrated Christmas for 12 days, as in the 12 days,
12
of,
days
Christmas.
Of Christmas.
From December 25th to January 6th, it was the longest and most enthusiastically celebrated public festival in the Elizabethan calendar. It was a time of lively social activities with games and sports and music and feasting at all levels of society. Gifts were exchanged on New Year's Day. They would have celebrated, in Shakespeare's day, they would have celebrated five feast days at Christmas time. December 26th, which is the Feast of St. Stephen. December 27th, the Feast of St. John. December 28th, the Feast of the Holy Innocents. January 1st, the Feast of the Circumcision.
That doesn't sound like...
Even though the Jews were having to hide celebrating Hanukkah. And January 5th, 12th night, or Epiphany Eve.
Or the Feast of Kings. And Twelfth Night, of course, is the name of a very, very famous Shakespeare play that many of you are no doubt extremely familiar with. Lisa and I both appeared together in that play.
Yeah,
that's nice. Of course, that play actually has nothing to do with Christmas. At least Christmas doesn't figure at all in that play. But as we will talk about later on, it was almost certainly performed on Twelfth Night itself, January 6th.
That's right. So let's talk about how the Elizabethans celebrated Shakespeare.
Oh, wait a minute. Sorry to interrupt you, but we forgot to tell our listeners about their Christmas present.
Oh my goodness, we completely forgot. Well, you guys, we have a very special Christmas present for you at the end of the episode, so you have to listen.
That's right. You have to listen all the way through, but it's a very special gift from us to you for Christmas.
So... Let's discuss how the Elizabethans celebrated Christmas. They had a couple of traditions. Let's start with those. One of the traditions was the Yule log, which a lot of people know now as that video on YouTube that you can play with a crackling fire for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, it used to be on WPIX here in New York.
That's right. It was one of the most popular traditions at Christmas time. A large log would be selected in the forest on Christmas Eve, decorated with ribbons, dragged home and laid upon the hearth. Then the log would burn throughout all the 12 days of Christmas. If you want to make your own Yule log, you can wrap and tie festive ribbon around your own, hot glue candles or cranberries or mistletoe as decoration, throw it in the fire. You got a
done and dusted. Isn't that I think the Yule log is a tradition that dates back to the Vikings, is it not?
Yeah, it's super old.
There was a time like well over 1,000 years ago when the Vikings controlled much of England. And so that Viking tradition carried over into English tradition.
Yeah. The Yo-ho-to-hoing was... No, I'm kidding. It's Christmas, you guys. Yeah,
no Wagner after half hour.
Another tradition was the kissing bow. Today, we have the Christmas tradition of kissing a sweetheart underneath a sprig of mistletoe. This tradition actually dates back centuries all the way to Elizabeth I and even earlier. In Shakespeare's time, one of the most popular Christmas decorations was called a kissing bow. It was essentially a wreath or a globe that was woven from mistletoe or ash or hazel or willow and covered in evergreens, and visitors would be embraced under it as a sign of goodwill.
So that's the origin of kissing under the mistletoe, right?
That's right. That's right.
Sort also, of a, yeah, Elizabethan and any, booty call for Christmas?
The kissing booty call?
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So they would also decorate their homes with holly and ivy, the holly and the ivy, box, yew, bay, laurel, holm oak, and in fact, anything that was still green. Both church records and household accounts from that time show money spent for holly and ivy to be bought to decorate for the holiday. In the church itself, along with the greenery, they would have a wooden figure of the Christ child because the creche thing hadn't become a thing quite yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
And of course, more modern traditions like the Christmas tree and presents under the tree, that didn't happen until Victorian times.
That's right. And that all comes from pagan stuff anyway.
Well, also, yeah, the Christmas tree is a German tradition. And it was really Queen Victoria and Prince Albert that established that much, much later on, because they were both German, really.
That's right. But they brought a lot of lovely traditions. So who minds? They also played tons of games at Christmas time. Would you like to tell our listeners about the Lord of Misrule, Owen?
Sure. The Lord of Misrule was a tradition that dated back at least a few hundred years before Shakespeare's time. And it was basically, Christmas time was looked forward to for a bunch of reasons, but largely because there was a leveling of social class in celebration. So it was a time where the lower class people could mix with the upper class people. And often they would choose a sort of jester figure called the Lord of Misrule, usually somebody who was of the lower class, to be the master, basically the master of the revels. And he would run things and basically promote chaos and merriment.
That's right.
Throughout the holidays.
Here's an interesting little tidbit about that, though. A group that dominated the festivities at court in Elizabeth's day were the gentlemen of Gray's Inn, one of the inns of court. Mm-hmm. So they were lawyers, right? And they would select what they called a prince of Purpool, their particular name for a lord of misrule, to serve as a master of ceremonies. So they were kind of like the stars of Christmas in London.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the centerpiece of all Elizabethan Christmas festivities were the games and entertainment. They would sing carols, they would dance rounds and jigs, wassailing, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and some games like, there was one called Hoodman's Blind, that's kind of an early version of Blind Man's Bluff, and there was one called Hot Cockles.
Oh, Hot Cockles is my favorite, and not just because of the name.
It's when a blindfolded player is repeatedly struck by others playing the game until the blindfolded player could guess who was dealing the blows. Hopefully harmless, but thankfully that has fallen out of favor.
Actually, when I was a kid, we used to play a game called Hot Peas and Butter. And the whole point of that game was like the person who was it would have a belt. And then people would have to hide. And the whole point of the game was for whoever was it to yell hot peas and butter and everybody would have to freeze. And then the guy with the belt would try to hit people until they got to home base.
That's insane.
It was a lot of fun.
Where did that come from?
Well, it's sort of like Hot Cockles.
Kind of like Hot Cockles, yeah. They also had like other sort of out of court pastimes. Henry VIII, Elizabeth's father, had a small forest planted at Greenwich so that they could go hunting at Christmas time, for one thing. And they would do things like foot combats. They played cards and dice during the festivities. But a big thing were plays, and they were frequently performed at court. Shakespeare debuted both Love's Labour's Lost and King Lear at the Christmas festivities of Queen Elizabeth I and James I and the VI, respectively. And even though viewing plays was a popular pastime, members of the court frequently performed themselves, putting on masks for their own amusement and the enjoyment of their peers, but most importantly, their superiors.
Yeah, actually, in Shakespeare's background, because performances were such a popular thing at Christmas time, he probably had a good front row seat to most of the plays and festivities in Stratford, because his father was an alderman and later basically the mayor of Stratford. So his father was, at least for a short time, responsible for contracting, selecting, and paying the troops of actors that came through. Of course, it's speculation, but it stands to reason that Shakespeare, young Shakespeare, would have seen a lot of those performances.
Let's talk about the Christmas feast.
Yes, the food.
Oh my God, the food. So the Christmas feast was the highlight of the year, especially for those houses that could afford it. No expenses were spared, because Christmas in the 16th century in England is best illustrated by the old adage, eat, drink, and be merry. Before Elizabeth's time, they didn't have much cause for celebration because it was during the years of Mary Tudor, or Bloody Mary, who reigned from 1553 to 58 and saw about 300 people burnt at the stake for heresy. So when Elizabeth got on the throne, it was a welcome change.
Well, yeah, and it's not like Elizabeth's dad was any treat.
Yeah, no,
living under Henry VIII.
He wasn't a party either.
Yeah, a little bit better.
But he was better than Mary. So feasts for gentry and the aristocracy were as extravagant as the entertainment. So that like the price of food for a night and his guests for the 12 days of Christmas would typically exceed about £100, which would translate to about $26,000 today.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Although realistically, here in the United States, we're like, buy your person a car for Christmas, which can often be way more than $26,000. But that sounds like a ridiculous amount to me.
Well, it's conspicuous spending, right? I mean, a lot of the times, certainly in noble households, the idea was to obviously be spending, to show how wealthy you were by the lavish feasts that you would provide.
That's right. That's right. So like I said, the Christmas feast was the highlight of the year. A popular main dish was brawn and mustard, which was made from force-fed boar meat.
Mm.
The boar was one thing, but the force-fed just turned me off. But other traditional meats included roast beef, goose, and turkey, which was first introduced to Europe from the Americas during Henry VIII's reign, and gradually rose in popularity as a Christmas dish because it was cheap and quick to fatten. But for the well-to-do, the most traditional meat eaten on Christmas Day was goose. In fact, it is said that in 1588, Elizabeth ordered the entire country to serve goose at their Christmas feast because it was the first meal she had eaten following England's victory over the Spanish Armada, and she wanted to provide a fitting tribute to the Navy Royal.
Fair enough.
That said, I mean, most households wouldn't have been able to comply because goose at that time was a really expensive luxury.
Yeah, mince pie, also one of the traditional foods of Shakespeare's Christmas time. And mince pie is traditionally a meat pie that's often filled with 12 different ingredients to symbolize the 12 days of Christmas.
That's right. And those would also be accompanied by plum porridge and a beer that was brewed specially for the occasion. The most significant addition to the Christmas table during Elizabeth's reign was plum pottage, which is first recorded in 1573, related to what we later know as plum pudding, which would in turn become Christmas pudding. It was sort of a soupy stew based on beef and raisins, currants and bread with spice if you can afford it. They were a staple food for rich and poor alike. They just differed in their contents.
Yes, spice if you can afford it is a good point, because like they're the sweet meats, which is what the Elizabethans called like what we would call candy.
Right.
But those were spiced with, you know, sugar and of different spices from the West and East Indies and Morocco and the Barbary Coast.
Right, so like that was nutmeg and mace, cloves, anise, coriander, rosewater, almond, or saffron.
And that's really expensive stuff, right? So again, a lot of times this was like a feast for the eyes as well as a feast for the palate. Because
totally.
You're showing off that you can afford this.
Totally. I mean, you know, England basically owned the sea at that point, so...
They were beginning.
Right. Yeah. But at an aristocratic Christmas meal, they would have dramatic centerpieces for affluent tables, like roasted swans and peacocks placed at the center of the table, their feathers still in place, despite the birds having been thoroughly cooked. The trick was to skin them for the roasting process and then slip them back into their skins. How crazy
Gross.
Is that?
Yeah, they also sometimes... Sometimes the head of the peacock would be poking through, like, and they would gild the beak.
That's right. That's right. They also served wild boar with the animal's head, you know, like providing like another spectacular table decoration. But the pièce de résistance would have been the banquet course, right? Which is where we would have had the sweetmeats. The Elizabethans discovered a whole host of ways in which they could use sugar once it started to be imported from the West and East Indies and Morocco and Barbary, not just in desserts and confectionery, but also like seasoning vegetables and medicinal remedies. The downside of eating so much sugar was that it made your teeth rot, and it is said that Queen Elizabeth's teeth went completely black because of her vast appetite for sweets.
Nice.
So during the banquet, a trencher, which is like a wooden plate or a platter, would be placed in front of each guest. A delicacy would be presented on the unpainted side, which, you know, might include some of the things we talked about, or marchpane, which we know today as marzipan or sweet gingerbread. They made a clear statement of wealth and status and power. But once the treat was eaten, the diner would turn over the trencher to find painted and gilded images and texts such as biblical texts and moral texts or humorous sayings, which would be read aloud and discussed among the guests. They were intended to provoke discussion and encourage storytelling, like a Christmas cracker today or even a fortune cookie.
Let's talk about wassailing.
Do.
Wassailing was a tradition that actually was the origin of people going around singing Christmas carols, caroling, right? Wassail is a drink, first of all. It's actually still made today with various, it's a kind of a punch, a warm punch made with cider and some form of alcohol. You can kind of choose whatever right. You want to do.
Usually like sherry or ale, spices and apples.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it comes, the tradition of caroling comes, it's an ancient pagan holiday tradition of showing charity to the poor at the winter solstice. And people would go door to door asking for alms and occasionally a warm beverage. And that's where the word wassail is actually an old Celtic word that means lamb's wool. It refers to the fact that the drink is covered with a thin foam that looks like the wool of a sheep. It's also derived from the Anglo-Saxon wassail, which means be in health. Right. So it's like a cheers. It's simultaneously a drink, a toast, and an explanation. Wassailing was an important part of the Shakespearean Christmas season. And according to a woman named Ellen Castillo, quote, the Lord of the Manor would greet the assembled multitude with a toast, wassail, meaning be well or be in health, to which his followers would reply, drink hail or drink well. So usually the wassailers would serve the beverage in a large bowl and sing carols as they drank. Sounds like a fun tradition.
Yeah, doesn't it? They drank other hot drinks then too, mulled wine, which sure. is hot wine infused with spices and sweetened with sugar, or syllabub, which is spiced hot milk flavored with rum or wine. I'll bet those bitches slept after that, right? Oh my God. I wanted to say something about Elizabeth and Charity, though, because you were talking about how wassail, like, you know, they were charitable and all that kind of stuff. Aristocrats and gentry traditionally used Christmas as a time to demonstrate their charity, right? Bestowing gifts and alms on their needier neighbors. The association between Christmas and charity ran deep in English culture, even after the Reformation had removed it. But Elizabeth used the occasion in 1596 to issue a formal proclamation encouraging a widespread campaign of charity throughout her kingdom.
Aw.
I wish they would do that in the United States and maybe pass that coronavirus relief bill.
Really?
Wouldn't that be fucking nice?
Oh my God. So let's talk about the handful of references to Christmas in Shakespeare's plays.
Yes,
there's surprisingly few of them.
Surprisingly few. Well, let's start with Christmas. There are three times that Christmas is actually mentioned by Shakespeare in his plays. The first one is Berowne from Love's Labour's Lost, Act 1, Scene 1. And he says, at Christmas, I no more desire arose than wish a snow in May's newfangled mirth. The second one is also Berowne. Interestingly enough, also from Love's Labour's Lost, Act 5, Scene 2. And he says, I see the trick on't. Here was a consent, knowing aforehand of our merriment, to dash it like a Christmas comedy. And then the third usage is Sly from The Taming of the Shrew, Induction, Scene 2. And he says, marry, I will. Let them play it. Is not a comedy a Christmas gambold or a tumbling trick? And then the last one I want to mention isn't actually a mention of Christmas, but a mention of New Year's. And I think it's important to mention this because of who speaks it. Hint, hint. And it's Falstaff from Merry Wives of Windsor, Act 3, Scene 5. And he says, have I lived to be carried in a basket like a barrow of butcher's offal and to be thrown in the Thames? Well, if I be served such another trick, I'll have my brains taken out and buttered and give them to a dog for a New Year's gift, because New Year's is when they gave gifts.
There is actually one description of Christmas time. Christmas isn't specifically mentioned, but it's from Hamlet, when I think it's Horatio is describing the season. And he says, some say that ever against the season comes wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated, the bird of dawning singeth all night long. And then they say, no spirit dare stir abroad. The nights are wholesome. Then no planet strikes. No fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is the time. So that's a description of Christmas time. It isn't actually specifically referenced, but.
And that's it, you guys.
And that's it. That's it.
That's it.
That's the shooting match.
But that being said, why don't we talk a little bit about Twelfth Night, Owen?
Right, because 12th, as we said before, Twelfth Night refers to January 6th, the Epiphany, the Feast of Kings, Twelfth Night, and all of that. And as we also said, there is no reference to Christmas in Twelfth Night. It's in the script of Twelfth Night. However, it's kind of assumed, nobody knows for sure, but it's assumed that it's called Twelfth Night, or What You Will, that's the subtitle, because it was likely to have been performed at court on January 6th. The very first, we do have a record of the first recorded performance on February 2nd, 1602, on Candlemas. And there's actually, this is interesting, it's the only play that ever received a contemporary review during Shakespeare's lifetime.
That is interesting.
There was a young lawyer named John Manningham who studied at the Inns of Court, the Middle Temple specifically, and he kept a diary. And he, in his diary on for February 2nd, 1602, he writes, "At our feast, we had a play called Twelfth Night, or What You Will, much like the Comedy of Errors or Menechmi in Plautus, but most like and near to that of the Italian called Injani. A good practice in it to make the steward believe his lady widow was in love with him by counterfeiting a letter, as from his lady in general terms, telling him what she liked best in him, and prescribing his gesture and smiling, his apparel, etc. And then he came to practice, making him believe they took him to be mad." So that's the only contemporary reference to somebody having witnessed a Shakespeare play during his lifetime. So it's very significant that way.
Is so cool. I mean, because he would have written Twelfth Night for a Twelfth Night celebration, right?
Almost certainly, although it can't be proved, but it certainly is suggestive. That otherwise, why would he name it Twelfth Night, right?
And actually, when you think about it, like Twelfth Night festivities in general, because they were huge part of Christmas time celebrations in England. They were like were raucous. They were full of drinking and mischief making. A tradition for Twelfth Night was for men to dress up as women and women to dress up as men, and for servants and masters to switch roles for a short time. So isn't it interesting then that both of these themes appear in Twelfth Night? Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, and Festy are such important parts of the show. Their drinking and their revelry match all of the contemporary Twelfth Night celebrations, right? And we can see Malvolio trying to play master rather than servant all throughout the play. And then, of course, there's Viola's cross-dressing that fits right into the Twelfth Night festivities.
Yeah, and Sir Toby acts as a kind of Lord of Misrule.
That's right. That's totally right. Here was an interesting... odd tradition for a Tudor Twelfth Night. There was one that involved a cake, a bean, and a pea, and they were baked into the vegetables were baked into a cake. And the man who found the bean became king for the night, while the lady who found the pea became queen.
Hmm.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. And I just want to stick in one more review of Twelfth Night, not from Shakespeare's day, but from not long afterwards. Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist who many of you may have read, actually saw Twelfth Night three times in the 1660s, but he was not a fan. In fact, he wrote quite a bit about it, but the third time he saw it, this was his take on it. He said, "Thence to the Duke of York's house and saw Twelfth Night as it is now revived, but I think one of the weakest plays that ever I saw on stage." So Samuel Pepys, not a fan.
Not a fan. But like we were saying earlier, speaking of revelry and presents and Twelfth Night and Christmas, we have something very special for all of our listeners.
Oh, we do. But I want to mention one other connection of Shakespeare and Christmas. Little known fact that Shakespeare indirectly inspired Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Get out.
No, it's true. Robert L. May, who is the person who created the character of Rudolph.
Yeah.
For a series of stories about Rudolph that later became the famous song. He created that character for Montgomery Ward. He worked as a copywriter for the department store.
Yeah.
And he was a huge fan of Shakespeare and Verdi. So get this. Speaking of Falstaff, which we're going to get to.
Yes.
One of Falstaff's companions is Bardolph. Right?
That's Bardolph, right?
Sounds a little bit like Rudolph.
Rudolph!
Bardol famously has a red nose.
Because he's a drunk.
Because he's a drunk, right? So hold on, hold on. So it gets better. In the opera Falstaff by Verdi, Falstaff sings. So also, Bardolph is the prime antlered deer when they're tricking Falstaff at the end of Merry Wives of Windsor.
That's totally right.
And in the opera Falstaff, get this. Falstaff has the line, I won't read it in Italian, but it translates to, I swear to God, Bardolph, with your nose so bright, you'll guide me to the tavern tonight, but you'll cost me more in wine than you'll save in oil.
That's so amazing.
So Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer comes indirectly from Shakespeare via Verdi.
Wow.
Is that crazy?
That is totally cool. Well, friends, as we said earlier, we have a very special gift for you from the podcast.
We enlisted our dear friend and brilliant actor, Keith Howard, to narrate a little Christmas poem for you, from us to you for Christmas.
A Visit from St. Falstaff. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Twas the night before Christmas, we're recording the pod, discussing our favorite topic, the bud. Our mics were all nestled real snug on their arms while we chatted and worked our podcastical charms. We talked about topics for an upcoming show, one that gives pleasure, not one that would blow. L.A. with her ganja and O with a drink, we were settling in for a deep Shakespeare think.
We've talked about gender, we've talked about race, we've talked about film till we're blue in the face.
We talk and we talk and I feel like a schmuck. Even Shakespeare himself would say, who gives a fuck?
How much can you talk about poor Desdemona? Our listeners wish that we'd both get the Rona.
When outside our studio we heard such a ruckus that we paused our recording and got up off our tuchus. We looked through the window and saw a strange light that was glimmering brightly throughout the dark night.
What the fuck is that glowing?
L.A. said, very fussed.
Wait, do you see it too?
Owen asked as she cussed. And what to our wondering eyes should appear? Sir John Falstaff himself, shotgunning a beer. With a wink and a belt, he addressed us by name. At his whistle, a bevy of characters came. No, Hamlet! No, Shylock! Now, Bottom and Romeo! On, Beatrice! On, Troilus! On, Caesar and Dremio! In iambic pentameter, or the blankest of verse, tell these two schmoes that it's time to rehearse! His eyes were so bleary, his gut was so fat, he smiled at us though, like a drunk Cheshire cat. He wobbled and weaved, almost falling a little, his nose red and veiny, his mouth full of spittle. He was chubby and plump, this right crusty old fart, and he reached back to grab something out of his cart. He picked up a stein, and he waved it about. I know you need topics, I haven't a doubt. He chugged down the ale, drinking all in one go, saying, I haven't forgotten the two of you, though. I'm leaving these characters with you tonight. I know they'll inspire. I know they'll delight. Now, just be yourselves and don't fuck with the process, or else your podcast will turn into a hot mess. He turned on his heel, that big bucket of booze, and then the old asshole threw up on his shoes. And we heard him exclaim as he lay in the sick, Merry Christmas to all! It's Shakespeare, you dick!
The preceding podcast was a production of Country Matters, LLC, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.